Planet Earth 1999. He's back, and it's about time.
Who are you?
I am the Doctor!
In the fight for eternity.
By midnight tonight, this planet will be pulled inside out.
There can only be one master.
I never liked this planet, Doctor.
Paul McGann is Doctor Who.
Don't panic! Everything is under control!
Monday, the 27th of May on BBC One.
I'm the Doctor, by the way.
You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that is delighted to bring you a set report from the TV movie 26 years after it happened. We're back again as we look to explore those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord, as played by Paul McGann. I'm Rebecca Chapman.
And I'm Kenny Smith. And you join us as we continue on our ongoing mission. Is it going to last 5 years like the Enterprise is? I don't think so. To feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen in books, novellas, full cast audios, short trips, comics, animations, talking books, magazines, and anything else that falls into our laps. But hopefully not people, because that might be rude.
Yeah,
well, unless they've fallen over, of course, and then obviously we've caught them, and then that would be good manners, because to let somebody fall onto the ground would be bad manners.
Very true.
Because it could induce a spinal injury. While I may be a qualified first aider as of about 6 weeks ago, don't really want to have to apply it just in case. So listeners, please be careful if you're walking and don't fall over. Please don't injure yourselves, because I can always be there to help you. A bit like the Green Cross Code man used to say. So yes. Anyway, Becca, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. Are you looking forward to this week's chat?
I am looking forward to this week's chat. Unfortunately, I've still got this blooming cold and I'm still getting over it, but I am looking forward to this.
Yes, indeed. Now, quick question. Have you ever been to the recording of a TV show or film? Or have you seen it ever taking place on the streets near your house or anything like that?
No.
Oh, that was a quick and easy answer.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, I have. Way back when I was, 16, 17, I went to the studios of STV in Glasgow and watched them doing an episode of Wheel of Fortune. Here's a British reference. Carol Smiley was the girl who did the letter turning at the time. And I accidentally looked down her top and... because she was sat in front of me and I accidentally looked down her top. And then I was out for dinner last year and she was at the table sort of diagonally opposite from me. And I did not mention, of course, this incident, because that would just have been weird and creepy. Anyway, I've also been at other recordings over the years and like TV quiz shows in Glasgow. There was one called Space Cadets, which had William Shatner on it many moons ago. Sylvester McCoy, Craig Charles. So yes, a few sort of sci-fi names. Bill Bailey was one of the team captains. On that.
Love Bill Bailey.
Oh, he's fantastic. Good dancer too, apparently.
Dancer.
Oh, yes. And obviously I was in a TV studio when we did the recording of that episode of Eggheads that I was on with the Glasgow Doctor Who fans. Yartek Thistle was our team. And I managed to beat my egghead, put it that way. I beat Chris. Haha. And I've also been to the filming of a feature that had Pierce Brosnan in it, actually, but I missed him by a day. It's a film called The Game, and it was about two Scottish pub teams. But I did get to meet Richard E. Grant and Samantha Fox on set and shake hands with them. So I met the voice of the... Oh, no, he wasn't the voice. He was the Great Intelligence when he was possessed later on. And, of course, the alternate universe Ninth Doctor from Scream of the Shalka. Scream if you want to go Shalka, baby. No, I'm not Jerry Halliwell. Sorry, have I taken drugs? What the hell is in my spearmint tea today?
It sounds like it.
No. Anyway, maybe we should get back on topic, because this week's guest had the incredible honour of being one of just a handful of journalists on set for the filming of the TV movie.
I am extremely jealous. It sounds absolutely amazing.
I am too. I mean, you think of all the Doctor Who that's been shot on the streets of Britain in recent years, and I suppose Cardiff, more London, and more recently there've been a fair bit in Bristol. But I've never been there to see it being filmed, and I'd love to have seen it, but it was not to be. Anyway, today we're going to be joined by Gary Gillett, who was the editor of Doctor Who magazine back in 1996, and he was one of the people who flew over to the shooting of the movie. So let's hear from him all about his experiences in Canada, how he found it all, and what memories have stuck with him to this day. Oh, and he's also, and this is the cool bit, a regular listener to our podcast.
Oh, Gary, we love you.
Tell Gary we love him. What the hell have I taken today? I've just come back from Wagamama's with a couple of members from our NMAP team, which is nursing and associated medical healthcare practitioners. We had a good lunch because it's Saskia's birthday on the 26th, I think it is. So Saskia, if you're listening, probably not, happy birthday.
That's very nice.
Yeah, I was chatting to Saskia about you earlier today, Becca, so there we go.
That's concerning.
No, in a good way, good positive way. I'm just saying about talking about my podcast pal, so there we go. Actually, officially, we're podcast pals.
Podcast
pal. No, this is, I really have no idea what was in my Wagamama at lunchtime. So I think we're better. Let's speak to Gary now.
My name is Gary Gillett. I am now the executive editor of Inside Soap. But back in the day, 25 or more years ago, I was the editor of Doctor Who magazine at the time of the Paul McGann TV movie.
You did that almost in one breath. Well done, Gary. I like it. But welcome to Pieces of Eighth. It's a delight to have you on.
It's a pleasure to join you. I very much enjoy the podcast. So
that's very kind of you to say so. You're actually our second guest who's come on, who actually knew and had listened to some of the podcast before they came on, following on from Jeremy Raddick, who was, of course, Gareth in the TV movie and was a huge fan of Doctor Who beforehand.
I mean, august company then.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. So what do you remember about first hearing that the TV movie was an actual goer?
Oh, now, this is the thing. The exact order of events, I can remember the big happenings quite clearly, but the actual order of events in the run-up becomes a little bit cloudy. Obviously, it's now 26 years ago, so 1996, and if I think about it, in that year, then 26 years before that would be 1970. So it's odd how, at that point, I'd have been pestering old actors like Caroline John to remember things that were happening, and they'd be going, oh, darling, it's such a long time ago. And I'd be like saying, how can you not remember? It was Doctor Who. But suddenly I find myself in the same place as them, 26 years on, people asking me what happened. And it's kind of odd how fast that time has gone by. But to answer your question, I took over the magazine as editor in, I think, the spring 95. And there was a sense that something was happening. We knew that Siegel had the rights, and we interviewed him soon after that, I think, during the late summer. And he'd had the early deal with Universal. And I think, as I remember, the politics, they were trying to find a broadcast partner. They had the production partner. And even then, it had been so long, and you'd had so many names mentioned in the context of who might bring it back. We never quite believed it, even though things were kind of, there was a script, and we confirmed the script, but it then suddenly kind of happened. Everything happened at once. I do remember we were forever running stories in Gallifrey Guardian about who the new Doctor would be, and reporting rumours, and sometimes we had to make them up because you had to print a picture of someone on that page and you ran out of people. So you go on the early internet places then, and you'd say something like, how about Eddie Izzard? And then you could say, and the forums are speculating, or fans are rumouring, Eddie Izzard is in the frame. So in this sort of mix of sort of real rumours and made up names, I think we suddenly mentioned Paul McGann, I think, in December. I seem to recall Sylvester was at a convention, and he mentioned that Britain was fighting for him and the Americans were kind of against him. I'm not sure. I think we reported it as being Sting then, but it could have been Harry Van Gorkum or one of those other names. And then suddenly the very next issue, the proper press release had come out. And as I remember, we just missed the dates production-wise. I think we just sent an issue to press and they announced it. So almost 4 weeks had passed before we did our proper magazine, where Paul was on the cover holding that kind of bit of, that kind of ashtray at Longleat or wherever it was. And by that point, we sort of had the news. And then by the time that issue came out on sale, I think I was already in Vancouver. So because of this sort of 4-week lag between the finishing of an issue and it going on sale, it all kind of trampled over itself. If that's not too long an answer to your very short question.
Not at all. So how did the trip come out? Because I know there were, I think it was just yourself and the Radio Times that went out, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a few more. It was quite odd. I mean, at this point, I was, what was I, 96? I was 25. So I was just, from my viewpoint now, I was just a child. And we'd been pestering BBC Press as well we might for information. We had a reasonably good relationship with them. And then the invitation came through, and on the flight with me, as I recall, were Alison Graham from the Radio Times. There was the Express, I think the Mirror, and another newspaper. And I remember there being multiple tabloids there because in studio, the tabloids weren't allowed to speak to Paul. Paul had a couple of kind of burns in the past, so he only allowed through the kind of less tabloid press. But a key thing for me was on the date of his announcement and the day he did that shoot at Longleat, which I think was the day before he then went out to Vancouver, and that again was the day before we actually started filming. It was all so swift. I'd been asked by the Independent newspaper to write a little piece welcoming him to the role. That they had a format there that was an open letter that people would write to kind of either a hero or a politician or something whimsical, and I did a general welcome to the role and great good luck and the positivity that all fans always have to a new doctor, of course. And he had been handed a fax of that, I think, on arrival in Vancouver, and he mentioned that when I met him, and he said that would really help with his nerves because he had no sense of what the programme was in a real sense in terms of it having a fandom, what his responsibilities to it were beyond it being an acting job. He knew it was significant, but was like, what is this? And then between my thing and I think obviously kind of Sylvester's explanation of the facts, that they're nuts, but they're the right kind of nuts, and they'll be your friends for life if you treat them with respect. They'll pay your mortgage and then some. So I kind of helped warm him up towards fandom. So all of that opened those doors. And as to why I went, normally I would have sent a freelancer, but we didn't have any money to pay for it all. We didn't know what to really do. We couldn't, the magazine was so sort of, had such a small budget. The only way to make the finances of it work was to sort of send myself and then freelance the writing back to myself. I didn't have a credit card at that time, and so I very quickly took one out, paid for my ticket, paid for my hotel in Vancouver, and bless the BBC, they booked us into, it's called the Sutton Place. It was a 5-star downtown Vancouver hotel, and I'd never seen anything like it. So I was burning this up on the credit card. And after 3 days, after the Radio Times and everyone else went home and I was hanging on hoping for another studio trip, I moved over to a youth hostel just to stop hemorrhaging money because I was thinking, how many more thousand words am I going to have to write when I sort of freelance this back to myself? Anyway, another long answer to your question.
So what was it like when you got there? Do you remember first things that you saw? Was it on the TARDIS set, or were you on location or anything like that?
Well, I was never on location. It was the middle of what should have been the final week. They had, as best I recall, they had about 25 days to shoot the thing, and that was always a big stress because they'd originally required 30. The original plan was to have 30, and that was, I think, cut back very late. So by the time I was there, and it was, I remember because it was the 14th of February, it was Valentine's Day, my first day in studio, because my boyfriend sent me flowers. It was very sweet. To this hotel in Vancouver, which was quite hard pre-internet. So it's quite, that was quite cute. So we went out, and it's about half an hour's drive from the centre of Vancouver, out in the sticks up a hill, I think it's called Eastlake Studios, and you're in quite a boring kind of industrial park, and we got out of the minibus, and the first thing I saw was a little sign that said Doctor Who parking. Now, we were banned from taking cameras on set, but I had one with me, and I was determined to take a picture of something, so I was excitedly, the first thing I had was a picture of this parking sign, and everyone else in the van, these proper journos, thought I was absolutely nuts. But, you know, all this time off air, to see that Doctor Who had parking felt like a major step. I knew in some abstract sense that it was that behind these doors the program was filming, but even at that point, still didn't quite believe it. I mean, I've read the script, I'd seen the casting, but only when I was taking a picture of their parking sign did it really start to sink in. I think that's a sign of some mild mental lack of capacity. So anyway, indoors, into this space, it very grotty and grim inside. It's a working studio that's used by, obviously, a range of different shows that come in on a month-by-month basis. Go through a number of doors and into this kind of larger space where the main two sets were standing. And both of them were entirely enclosed sets, so you'd see the outside of them was just, you know, plywood and timber sort of holding these things up, sort of rooms inside the big room. But stood beside one was the police box, and that was the most kind of electrifying moment. Obviously, this kind of shape is kind of hard, as a fan, is kind of hardwired into your, almost into your, like, pleasure centres. You know, you can... Like the TARDIS shape, the Dalek shape, and the Target Books logo, you can see it in like other things. You can see it at 100 meters away. You can see it. You just have this kind of primal response, and there it was across the room, the TARDIS, and boy, was it beautiful. It was exactly. I think everyone now praises that prop that Richard Hadoulin made as amongst the most beautiful that the show's had. And it was, you know, it was a very moving thing. And then right alongside it was another one. So you not only had the thrill, you also had this kind of Legopolis thrill. The only other time you'd seen that happen, because it was the one that was kind of like twice as wide for the motorcyclist to drive in. And I can remember behind that there was a bit of the set of the alleyway, because they filmed, I think, that stunt within the studio. So they had the big poster, the big Visit Britain kind of poster behind it. And then from there, two doors to your right hand side, two large doors opened and entered the TARDIS control room through the TARDIS doors. And in, and it was lit for use for us, not the big lights, the actual kind of mood lighting. So the stepping inside of it was very much like the characters did on screen, and that was also quite profound. And Philip Seeger was our guide, and he was sort of jumping about like a schoolboy, running around showing us all his favorite parts, and it very big and complicated, dizzying to try and take in the detail. But the main feeling was that, because of all the doubts and rumors that fandom had about it, by that point a lot had leaked about the kisses, about the Americanization, about there being a car chase, and there was as many fears as there were, there's much dread as there was positivity, as ever. But I think on seeing that set was the moment, and seeing the TARDIS prop as well, was knowing that something proper was being done, that it was as good as you could, and what better than you could imagine it being, better than it deserves. It was like when Rose came back and everyone watched it and went, oh, thank God. That could have gone so horribly wrong, that sense of relief that you were in good hands. So that's what the TARDIS feeling had. It was not to be kind of too squiffy about it. It was like, oh, it's all come home.
That's amazing. Had you been told to expect a bigger TARDIS, given what we'd been used to with the likes of, particularly in the later years in Sylvester's time, the small squeeze it in any corner.
There've been a few sort of, I'd read the script, and so there's a few clues in the script, and I'd seen the Leakley Bible, and I think at that point Philip had been interviewed before talking about his vision for the TARDIS, and they're supposed to have an infinity chamber and all these other rooms, and so we were prepped for something of that ilk. I must admit, it was smaller than we'd been led to expect, but nevertheless, when you're inside it, because it has this structure that's a number of concentric circles. There's the console, the plinth, the girders, there's marble pillars, and then beyond that, sort of this sort of heavy green kind of drapery. You couldn't see the edges of it, so you it kind of enclosed you and wrapped around you. It tricked your eye in lots of ways, which it does very much on screen. And from there, we went into the cloister room. No real cloisters, of course, but certainly lots of room. And that was stunning too. And again, it went right round you on four sides. Now, on those days, that was the active set, because they spent the day shooting the final fight scene. They were running out of time, and they were about to lose Eric Roberts. So they were shooting just Eric Roberts' side of that fight in quite a panic way, and then ready to shoot the reverses with the rest of the cast in their overrun days the next week. So throughout the day, there was a real kind of manic energy. Everyone knew they were about to overrun, and so everyone was quite stressed. But the cloister room, again, likewise, was absolutely dazzling to see.
I'm quite jealous. I take it these memories sit quite vividly, because it was something so unique.
Yeah, I think I realise I'm blessed. I didn't have a chance to. I was too young to attend any kind of recording of the original series. I've been on set a few times in Cardiff, but I do realise I was very, very lucky. I don't know if any other fans made it onto that set during production. It may very well be a unique opportunity that I had. Certainly very rare, a sort of a real moment in history, because it only stood for a few days. It had this kind of mayfly life. So yeah, I was very lucky to be kind of eyewitness to that little slice of Doctor Who history.
Did you get to play with the console at all? Because I would find it quite irresistible if I was near it.
No, we were not allowed to touch it. Philip enjoyed it. He was spinning things about, and I can recall that the central column was actually operated by a switch on the console, in which is a very rewarding thing to be able to do. So he wowed us with that. But one really knows not to touch a kind of hot set. I know this in a real sense, because when I was reporting on An Adventure in Space and Time, and I got to go on the recreated Hartnell set, I did go to press a switch on that, and it was actually really hot, and I burned my finger. So, never touch props.
Yeah. Literally hot property.
Yeah, hot property, and I got right telling off too. So, so don't go fiddling with the TARDIS, kids, if ever you get to go on one.
Yeah. And what was the mood like on set, from what you recall? Because I know you did say later that you could tell that it wasn't going to go to series. But what was the feeling amongst the cast and crew at the time?
Exhaustion. Absolute exhaustion. We were showing upstairs into a meeting room. Always on these kind of set trips, be it any kind of show that you're on, there's a really unglamorous bit where you're sat in an uncomfortable room around a desk, and some actors who really don't want to be in the room are showed in to talk about some work which isn't finished, and they don't know how much they can say. Looking back, the interview that I had on set that day and published in full before the show was on with Paul McGann is mind-boggling in its content. Now, I had a little look back at it, and you'd never be allowed to do anything approaching that now. Not that he's kind of down on it, he's doubtful about it. He's exhausted. He's talking about it quite frankly about, well, we'll just have to see, kind of attitude. And the fact that I was allowed to print that kind of just kind of rumination, that kind of honesty, was very strange. So he'd been there for what, 20 days, and that they'd been back and forth between day shoots and night shoots, and no one had a good pattern. The fight scene in the cloister room was being rewritten day by day. The stuff that was in the script had been thrown out, and I think Philip was leading the writing with Cass chipping in, and they were just kind of assembling it on the floor. So yeah, everyone was absolutely exhausted, and Paul was in his costume, in that wig, in that more kind of sweaty, grimy, dirty mood. So if you watch that scene, that fighting with the master, and sort of using those sort of things with Rassilon's head on to bludgeon each other or whatever, you have to imagine him sort of stepping up, leaving that room, and coming in to sit down with me and tell me about his feelings, and then returning to it. So yes, they were exhausted. Eric Roberts was kind of, he had a separate kind of press team, and we were kind of, someone scary had come in to tell us what we couldn't ask him about. So we were expecting some sort of beast, but he was as lovely as can be. Mm-hmm. All he was excited about was his cloak. His dress for the occasion cloak, which he'd only come to quite late in the process. If he'd had that at the start of his month of shooting, I think that we'd have had quite a different master, because I think he really embraced the camp of it at the very last second. But yeah, it's still a great performance. So yes, everyone was knackered. And then the journalist who'd only there to speak to actors went home, and I went into Phil's office to get some stuff, the sort of thing that only the fans would be interested in. And he was very weary about the whole thing. The fight to get it made was still being fought on a day by day, dollar by dollar basis. The idea that then that might be followed by another fight to push it into a series, I think, just seemed like too much. He couldn't see how it could be done. So it wasn't that there was a defeated air. It was more, defeat isn't the word, more kind of just, everyone was just like the Walking Dead was the tone.
Yeah, it's a shame, considering that, you know, how much heart and soul and good feelings went into it. You know, everybody went into it with the best will in the world, but it just seemed to be ground down by the process.
Yeah, well, the thing about the TV movie is it has no right to be as good as it is, and I think it's an episode that has only grown in esteem as time has gone by, and will only continue to do so. I mean, it is amazing how tonally it sits, how well it sits tonally between Survival and Rose, and the kind of settings and the sequences in it. I'm still not sure that they've made a kind of action episode look quite as good yet as that, even all these years on. That kind of, you know, nighttime car chase, motorway pilot sort of stuff, it's still, even in the years past, it's still always been a bit kind of Cardiff Ring Road. it still lacked a bit of that kind of, it is really Hollywood, and Paul McGann gets it exactly right. I'm not sure how much of it is in the script, and that's something I can recall actually meeting him in that studio, how doctory he was as a person. And you've met him and done work and seen him work. He has that thing that Tom has, Tom Baker has, where you actually find them very similar in how they come across in real life. Paul, when talking to you and when you're interviewing him, he has a voice which is very much like his doctor's voice, which is a very calm and explaining, well, the thing is, Charlie, don't you see? We're going to, but yes, what can we, you know, very, very like arriving in the chimes of midnight.
Yeah.
about to explore voice, and he speaks like that about his work, the same kind of quiet earnestness. So I was very captivated by him, and he's a completely captivating role. There's not a lot on the page for that Doctor. There's not a lot that says this is who this guy will be. I think he makes it all himself, and still now 25 years on, he lives on. He always refers to himself as the George Lazenby of Doctors, but of course, I mean, with respect to him, that's rubbish. He's probably recorded more time as the Doctor than anyone else. But yeah, sorry, I'm rambling it.
That's at all. I did put it to him when I got him earlier this year that he's now the Timothy Dalton of Time Lords. He's got a first film and he's got a last episode as well. So he thought that was quite good.
Yeah, he does indeed. Yeah.
So how do you look back on the whole thing now? Is it something that comes across your mind now and again, or is it something that sort of just like sleeps at the back of your mind to this
I don't know. I haven't had cause to watch the TV movie in quite some time. I watched it an awful lot around about then. It's all very mixed up in the time of my life. There was a lot happening then. I hadn't long been in London. I hadn't long been editing the magazine. My company was there was a big change of management right in the middle when Marvel was sold to Panini, and friends lost their jobs, and so all this was kind of very intense. So all of that is mixed up in one. But Paul McGann was very much occupied. I was very blessed to have that film to report on. Very blessed to be out and do the reporting on it. And even then, it then continued because I was in studio for his first audios for Storm Warning and the rest. In fact, I'm even in Storm Warning. I have a couple of lines. And then I went out there again when they did Sharda. So for a little while, every time Paul McGann played the Doctor, he'd look round and find me sat there. So yeah, that kind of sort of filled my time as editor, and then I kind of stepped back and it all became someone else's. So it was, yeah, it was special. It was an entirely unique kind of Doctor Who without any of the big BBC politics which it has now, the control of every detail. We were just kind of left to go at it. So that was great fun.
Yeah, I do have to admit, I'm sitting here hanging in every word and just thinking, oh, those memories. If only you had been able to, if you had a mobile phone and be able to get a few extra wee snaps. Sure, Big Finish would have paid you a few quid for those McGann and costume picks.
I had to, yes, indeed, a few more standing there. Between, I had to sit down and scribble, and it was all pen and ink and fax then. There's a Gallifrey Guardian reporting on the thing, which I had to write out longhand and fax in from the hotel reception on the report. So it was the last gasp of kind of proper scoop journalism. Here I am on set reporting live from Vancouver. but yeah, very quickly drawing what the control room looked like, what McCoy's new costume looked like, so that could be incorporated in the comic strip that was being drawn simultaneously back in London for Doctor Who magazine. But yeah. It's always a terrible photos on these things. They're always very secretive while it's shooting, but it's always a great regret that though that said, they did, every set is very well shot. Every dark and dingy blue and brown scene is very well shot, just not enough of the Doctor.
Yeah, in that wonderful 90s sci-fi blue that seemed to permeate the X-Files and every other show of the time.
Well, yeah, for 3 years working on the magazine after that, we always referred to whenever we're doing a McGann thing, we had to choose between a brown pick or a blue pick. Those were the two sets, and we were like, which one should it be? So yeah, good times.
Gary, it's been a real joy. Thank you so much for sharing your memories.
Thank you. I hope they weren't too too tedious and
no.
and pooterish.
No. Every last word's fascinating.
Thank you so much. You're very, very indulgent. Okay, thank you, and good luck with the podcast.
So a huge thanks to Gary for taking the time to have a chat with us, and I'm even more jealous now than I was when we started. If you've enjoyed this week's Pieces of Eight, please do leave a review for us on iTunes, as it means more people can find our episodes, and it's always appreciated.
And we'll be back next week when we'll be entering Big Finish territory for the first time this season, as we're going to be listening to one of their fantastic short trips. We're going to be listening to The Man Who Wasn't There, which is a rather fabulous tale starring Paul McGann. Well, it doesn't really star him. It stars the Eighth Doctor and Charlie Pollard. And it's read by India Fisher. And it's a snip at $2.99 from the Big Finish website.
I am a fan. I am a big fan. Yes. I like it a lot.
Yep. So until next time, I've been Kenny Smith.
And I was Rebecca Chapman.
Bye-bye, Becca.
Bye, Kenny.
Bye-bye, listeners.
Bye.
You're not the listeners. Come on, listeners, you can do better than that. Give us one more. Bye-bye, listeners. That's better. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.